Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode number 45 for Monday, May 10th, 2010. I could have been a contender. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. Welcome, everyone, to Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. It's episode 45, and get ready. It's 1 hour, one expert, and in this case, one topic that might turn into multiple topics. We'll see. We're talking about Pluto, if you're ready to get down and a little dirty in outer space stuff. And maybe Neanderthals, too, possibly. We'll see where we go with the show. Anyway, today I'm speaking with Alan Boyle. He is the science editor at MSNBC.com. He's worked in journalism for 32 years, notching up several awards for his fabulous scientific reporting skills. Among them, awards from the National Academies, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the National Association of Science Writers, the Society of Professional Journalists, the Space Frontier Foundation, the Pirelli Relativity Challenge, and the CMU Cybersecurity Journalism Awards Program. In his MSNBC.com blog, The Cosmic Log, Alan delves primarily into the physical sciences and space exploration, but don't be surprised if you also see writings about paleontology, archaeology, or just about anything else. Most recently, he is the author of The Case for Pluto, which we will talk a little bit about today. And according to his bio, he has survived a hurricane, a volcanic eruption, a total solar eclipse, and an earthquake. And he has faith that he's going to survive the internet, but we'll have to see if he survives 2012 first. So without further ado, Alan, it is wonderful to have you on the show. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. I just hope that I survive Skype.
I know all of this modern technology.
Yes, I'm just a caveman journalist. I don't understand all these flashing lights.
Just hit the little green button and it'll go, and that's good. All right, so let's get down to business with Pluto. It's your recent book, The Case for Pluto. Why does Pluto need a case made for it? What's the trouble with Pluto?
Well, it's been kicked around a little bit lately. In recent years, Pluto was the focus of this big international debate over whether it was a planet. Is it a dwarf planet? Is a dwarf planet a planet? How many planets are there? All this sort of stuff gets confusing, and a lot of people just want to write the whole thing off and say, well, let's just go with eight planets, and that's it for our solar system, and just stop there. But the bottom line is you shouldn't stop there, that you're really selling the diversity of the solar system short if you don't give some visibility, not only to Pluto. The case for Pluto is not just about one little ice ball. It's about a whole class of worlds out there that are really fascinating and really point the way toward other phenomena beyond our solar system. All the extrasolar planets that have been discovered, 450 plus so far, wow, are weird and wonderful. And we need to have a big tent for our planetary party here. We don't want a little tent planet system.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. We like to be all inclusive as much as possible. Do you think that the debate recently about what a planet is that debate ongoing in the scientific community, or are astronomers and cosmologists and people who decide these things, are they just like, okay, we pretty much have it figured out now. We have dwarf planets that are this size range. We have planets, planetoids.
Well, yeah. Any debate that's really worth debating continues. Let's look at evolution. That's one of the most most well-supported theories in science, and still there's a debate in society over this. And so you wouldn't expect, no matter how people decided, you wouldn't expect the debate to go away immediately just because somebody takes a vote. That's one of the big issues with the case of Pluto, that astronomers thought, okay, we take a vote and all in favor of Pluto not being a planet say aye, and okay, we've taken care of that, everybody else goes along. Well, that's not how science works. And fortunately, this whole debate has really given a lot of exposure to other planetary issues. What about brown dwarfs? What about asteroids? Obama has said that the first place we're going to go in deep space is actually an asteroid. And so if you think that an asteroid is just a little piece of cosmic junk, then you say, well, who cares? What's the big deal, Barack? But if you realize that these are primordial bits of the solar system, things that can kill us, things that can give us fuel and supplies to go far beyond our little corner of the solar system, then you start to realize that these are really important items and we should be giving a little more attention to how we classify them.
Yeah. Do you think that a lot has changed in terms of how we classify things? I mean, since Pluto was discovered in the early 1900s, how far have we come since that time?
Oh, yeah. It's been 80 years this year since Pluto was discovered. And since then, we've discovered an entirely new class, a new piece of real estate in the solar system. It's known as the Kuiper Belt. And there's that's a broad band of material, most of it icy, some not so icy. And beyond that, you've got this huge Oort cloud that goes maybe a third of the way to the next star over, a big reservoir for comets and icy worlds. You mentioned 2012.
And yeah.
it's possible that there is a big planet X out there in the Oort cloud that we haven't detected yet because it's so dim. But not to worry, sports fans, it's not going to kill us, even if we find it. And we may know for sure whether it's out there in the next year or so.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about Planet X. I mean, Pluto was thought to be the Planet X, right, at first?
Right.
And there's this, you know, the Grateful Dead have the song Dark Star, and there's like this whole idea of this other either
right
sister's mm-hmm. dark sister sun or even another big planet or something. That I mean, is this all part of the same idea of there's something else out there that's affecting gravitational?
Yeah, there are a couple of ideas out there. One is that there's a dark companion to the sun that is way out there in the Oort cloud and is stirring things up to send more comets through the inner solar system at one particular time rather than another time. And so that's when people are talking about a large planet X. They're looking for something that will explain those changes in our solar system. It's really theoretical right now, but that's one of the things that people talk about. And then another thing is the idea of this companion star that is going to pass by the sun and disrupt everything. And actually, astronomers are coming around to the view that that really did happen. It just happened millions or maybe even billions of years ago. And that may be one of the reasons why the solar system is structured the way it is, that you have a companion star that kind of makes a pass and disrupts the gravitational flow of things enough so that you get planets moving back and forth. There may have been a little bit of ultraviolet baking going on that made the planets the way they are today. You might have had a star that stirred the planets up, did some chemical changes to the planets, and actually put objects like Sedna where they are today. And so that's a very plausible hypothesis. It's the best hypothesis for explaining why some of the things about our solar system are the way they are today. But the big thing to consider about all these things is that they're not going to hurt us. They're not going to play into this Sumerian myth about a rogue planet that is going to come and just wipe out the Earth or anything like that. It's just another fascinating feature about the history of our solar system.
Okay. What are we using currently? What do you know? I know. Is there a mission currently?
What are you using?
What am I using? Yeah. What are you using? What are people using?
I'm high on life.
Excellent. I ask great questions sometimes. The ways that we're looking for these dark objects. Do we have new missions that are going out to search for dark objects? And do you know about
Absolutely. This? Absolutely. Yeah. There's all sorts of things that are being sent out or being built to look at these things. One probe that went up recently is the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, or WISE for short. Yeah. And that's designed to survey the whole solar system from one pole to the other in infrared. And it should be able to pick up a lot of dim asteroids, maybe thousands or tens of thousands of asteroids. And also, if there is a large planet X out there, it should be able to detect that as well by its faint infrared signature. There's a whole generation of telescopes that are coming online. For example, the Pan-STARRS telescope, the Discovery Channel telescope. All these kick it up a notch.
The Discovery Channel has a telescope?
Indeed. the guy who created the Discovery Channel has funded it, and so that's why it's called the Discovery Channel Telescope. It's not right. Like it's going to be a 24-hour telescope all the time channel. It's just that some of the money from that operation has basically gone into this telescope. But one of the first things that the Discovery Channel telescope is going to do is look for more of these dim Kuiper Belt objects, maybe objects that are like Pluto, maybe more likely objects that are smaller than Pluto, but it really gives you a good survey of what the terrain is out there. And the interesting thing about the Discovery Channel telescope is that it's housed at the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona. And that's where Pluto was discovered 80 years earlier. So everything is coming around full circle.
Absolutely. It absolutely is. And with Pluto, you mentioned the size of Pluto and whether we'll be seeing objects smaller than Pluto. Pluto has small moons, Charon and a couple of others.
Hydra.
Nix and Hydra. And Eris is the so-called 10th planet now, but not really planet, dwarf planet.
Yeah.
And is Eris another Kuiper Belt object? Eris is larger than Pluto.
Right. Eris, really interesting object. It's can be considered a Kuiper Belt object. Some people say it's way far out for a Kuiper Belt object. It's three times as far away from the sun as Pluto is. Mm-hmm. It's about 25% more massive than Pluto. Eris, in the beginning, was detected by Caltech astronomer Mike Brown. And for a while, it was known as the 10th planet. It was the planet that caused all the trouble where people had to figure out how to reclassify and reorganize the way that we thought of the solar system. So Eris used to be known as Xena, after Xena, the warrior princess.
The warrior princess. Who comes up with the names, and then who decides that, no, we're not going to name this moon, this small planet, after the warrior princess?
Well, Mike Brown actually came up with that name, and his team, as the informal name for anything that they found that would be bigger than Pluto. And it plays off the idea of Planet X, X for Xena, and it also plays off the idea that you name planets after mythological beings, like Xena is a sort of a faux mythological being. But Mike knew that that would not fly with the International Astronomical Union. The IAU is the body that actually gives its blessing to a new name for a planet or an asteroid or a comet. And so they have a particular convention for how these things are named. And so Mike came up with this name Eris, which is the Greek goddess of discord. And that, again, was sort of an in-joke, because Eris created a lot of discord among astronomers who are trying to figure out how to classify these things. And Eris has one moon that we know of called Dysnomia, which is named after the goddess of lawlessness.
Wow. Dysnomia is the...
Right.
I'm laughing about this personally because my best friend is named Naomi. I call her Nomi. And so Dysnomia.
Mm-hmm.
It makes a lot of sense, actually.
Now your friend has a new nickname.
Absolutely. You
but
heard it here first.
The interesting thing is that Dysnomia was the goddess of lawlessness,
yeah.
And it turned out that the actress who played Xena is Lucy Lawless. So
perfect.
Everything comes around full circle and usually ends up with syndicated television.
Wonderful. So in terms of, I've got this image here from NASA. It's just a graph of the outer solar system and the planets
yeah.
in the outer solar system. And can you talk at all about the orbits of Eris and Pluto and how they intersect with the other
yeah.
large gas giants?
Sure. Yeah. With this kind of top-down image, it looks as if Pluto is going to run into Neptune.
Yeah.
You know, that you think the orbits are going to intersect, but actually the orbits in 3D are constructed so that there's no way that Pluto will ever get anywhere close to Neptune, just because of the timing of the orbits as well as the position. In fact, Pluto comes closer to Uranus than Neptune in the course of its orbit. And that's because Pluto and Neptune are in a very special relationship. They're kind of like friends with benefits. Pluto goes around two times every time that Neptune goes around three times. And so there's a very delicate kind of clockwork going on with this. And so Eris is, again, in an orbit that is not in danger of actually hitting any of those things that you see where the orbits appear to be crossing, because it's in an even more inclined orbit than Pluto is. Pluto is inclined 17 degrees to the main plane of the solar system, the ecliptic, and Eris is more sharply inclined. It's 44 degrees to the ecliptic. And so when you look at it in 3D, you realize how well put together things are and how bizarre things can start to look. That it's not like you've got all these planets on one little racetrack, that it's really an organism with lots of interesting features and lots of interesting parts to it.
Yeah, and I'm just looking at the way it works. In movies, we see these fanciful models of the universe with the planets moving around, and old philosopher scientists, the Renaissance men, built these models of the universe, and I'm sure people now are modeling the universe yet on computers. Do you know if anybody's like sped it up a billion times and just to see if any interactions do take place far off into the future and at what point?
You can do that. Definitely modeling the interactions of the planets in the solar system, and people have done that and found that Pluto and Neptune are in a very stable resonance. That's what you call this type of orbit, and that it goes on for millions and millions and millions of years that way. In fact, if you run the model long enough, Pluto actually does kick out another Kuiper Belt object from its orbit. And so there you have an example of Pluto clearing out its orbit, which is one of the parts of the definition that became controversial for whether a thing is a planet or not.
Right, whether or not. So to define that more clear, you know, a little bit more for the audience, is that a planet has to be able to, I guess, like a bowling ball, clear the pins out of the path, be able to move things out of its orbit, be able to either accrete stuff or be able to just push it away. Is that more accurate?
Right. Clearing the neighborhood of the orbit means somehow you sweep the things out of that zone of the solar system in which you travel. So it gets kind of technical, and a lot of people were not too crazy about that part of it. They agreed that was kind of the weakest link in the definition. That's what distinguishes what you might call the dominant planets in the solar system from the dwarf planets. That the dwarf planets are large enough to kind of crush themselves through self-gravity into a ball, and you get a lot of interesting things that come along with that: differentiation, geology, the potential for volcanic activity, the potential to hold an atmosphere, that sort of thing. But you can't really sell the people who are getting into this clearing the neighborhood of the orbit thing short, that it's an important characteristic for a planet to be large enough to do that. The only question is, how do you classify those things, and is there a way that is useful to talk about dwarf planets as a subcategory of planets? And I think that makes sense, that for some planetary scientists, that's an important way to distinguish the different types of planets.
I love the when you look at also at the rings of Saturn, the way that the moons are actually clearing out the debris in their path through so you have the rings, and it seems like the moons all have cleared their own path, and so the rings of Saturn in themselves can be seen as a model for solar system development.
Right. Uh-huh. And there are some moonlets that are still embedded in the ring, that they have not, you know, created a gap in the ring itself, but that they exist as large pieces within a ring of smaller material. So that's a good model for how to consider Pluto, that there are some of those small moons of Saturn that are in a similar position, where they're embedded in an area where there's a lot of other surrounding material, and maybe they haven't cleared the neighborhood of their orbit, but yet they're large enough to stand out from the crowd and really earn the classification of a moon.
Right. Now, Pluto, I've got a great image from the Hubble telescope.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, and it's just this, it's a spheroid. It's got, but the view is very mottled. We don't have high resolution yet. What's going to give us...
Yeah, isn't that a shame?
It is a shame. Why aren't our cameras
Pluto
better?
never gets its due. But the reason for that is just that it's so far out. Those images are interesting because when you take it with images that were made earlier, they indicate that the surface of Moon has changed over time, that there are some areas that have become brighter, some areas that have become dimmer. So that indicates that a weather pattern is playing out on Pluto. So this is the best image that we have so far, the best series of images. But there is a probe called the New Horizons probe that was launched in 2006, and it's on its way to Pluto. It takes 9 years to get there, even though New Horizons was launched on the fastest rocket ever to leave Earth. And so in 2015, the New Horizons probe will fly by Pluto as well as its biggest moon, Charon, and send back the best images, and probably the best images we'll ever be able to get of a Kuiper Belt object, just because it's so distant and so hard to get to. After flying by Pluto, New Horizons will continue into the Kuiper Belt, and we should be able to get a look at some of the other objects in that zone of the solar system.
Is the New Horizons mission going to end up in an orbit around our solar system, or is it just going to, like the Voyager missions, just head on out?
The idea is that it would head on out.
Okay.
That's the way that it's structured. It's hard to say what's going to happen, but right now it's not designed to come back. It's designed to continue out into the outer solar system, and they definitely plan to have an additional target in the Kuiper Belt. They may be able to find some more. So who knows? This gig might be going on for decades.
Now, with Pluto, you mentioned with the images that there was weather playing out over the surface. And Pluto has an atmosphere. It has weather.
Yep.
Tell me about this.
It does. It has a very thin nitrogen and methane atmosphere. And it actually has clouds of ice in that atmosphere. And it's thought that when Pluto gets into its farthest remove from the sun, it may be that methane frost will freeze out of the atmosphere and fall onto the surface. And that may be part of what's going on, that methane frost is being transported from one part of the planet to the other because of very faint atmospheric changes brought about. Who knows? It's one of the mysteries about Pluto.
Yeah, and really all we have to go on are molecular images, so the way that light travels through the atmosphere,
right.
Are the chemical signature that we can pick up with our telescopes, and that's about it, right?
Right. Spectroscopic analysis of the light that is shining from a distant object through Pluto's thin atmosphere. Because from Earth, Pluto is just a speck. Everything that we've been able to learn about Pluto is just by watching for subtle variations in that speck of light.
I think that's just amazing. And Pluto and the moon, Charon, we have this nice image here. It's pixelated because that's the way the camera took the picture.
That's right. Yep. Can't
They've
do
blown
anything
it up.
About that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Charon is a moon, and the other two, Nix and Hydra, are moons of Pluto. What do we know about the moons of Pluto? And when did we find out that Pluto had moons?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. Charon, I think, dates back to the 70s. That was... In the book, I tell the whole story about how Charon was found and why it was named the way it was. Charon is, 50% as big as Pluto. And so that makes Charon and Pluto kind of the closest planet, dwarf planet, if you wish, and moon in the solar system. They're locked in an orbit around each other that... That when you look at Charon from the Plutonian sky, it stays in the same place. The same thing would happen to the moon if we waited long enough, several billion years. It would be locked in place.
As it moves further and further away,
it gets into tidal lock.
Right.
You got it. So Charon has more water ice than Pluto. And so it's thought that what happened was that some object smacked Pluto very early in its history, and the debris that came out of that collision coalesced into the moon Charon. Mm-hmm. And a similar thing happened to Earth and Moon, that back early in Earth's history, a Mars-sized object smacked into Earth, and it's thought that that led to the creation of the moon. So with Charon, because it has a larger percent of water ice, there are some indications that we're seeing cryovolcanism on Charon, where you have ice volcanoes. It's still, like everything else about Pluto and Charon, very tentative, but there's the suggestion that perhaps for some reason, liquid water is able to endure beneath the surface of Charon, and that gives rise to this sort of ice volcanism. The same sort of thing that you see on a larger scale with Saturn's moon Enceladus.
Right, and this is exciting to biologists such as myself because it could potentially harbor life. Where that we always think where there's water, there is life, but we're finding extremophiles all over the place. So, I mean, even a methane... cryovolcano has the potential. It's got organic pop building blocks there. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's very
That's
exciting.
Right. Yep.
What do you think? Is it, I mean, what's your...
I think it's a low percentage. I'm not going to put any money on that, but I think it's an intriguing thing to look at. I don't know how much we're going to be able to tell from the New Horizons flyby, but I think that we would get a sense whether for some reason there was some sort of cryovolcanism going on there, as well as on Pluto perhaps itself. So I think it's going to be interesting. I just wouldn't put my money on finding little critters down there.
You don't think that that Stephen Hawking's aliens are hiding out on Pluto or Charon?
Maybe behind Pluto. You know, they've just got their spacecraft poised, ready to strike.
That's right. They've found a nice little Lagrange point someplace that they can just hang out. Oh my goodness, I need to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors, so if you'll just hang on for just 1 second, Alan, I will be right back with you.
All righty.
Okay. Hello, everybody. I would like to thank Audible.com for sponsoring this hour of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. Audible.com is the largest provider of audiobooks with over 75,000 titles in genres ranging from science to fiction, from biographies to periodicals all across the board. There are even podcasts in there. There are audiobooks that you can download to your computer, to your portable media device, plug into your car, and be able to take with you wherever you go and listen to at your own leisure. Doesn't that sound nice? I think it does. Anyway, audible.com is offering a free audiobook download to any of you who are interested in trying out their service. So if you go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki, that's K-I-K-I, audiblepodcast.com/Kiki, you will get a free audiobook download with your trial of the service. It sounds like a pretty good deal. And I have actually, unfortunately, I wasn't able to find Alan Boyle's book in the Audible book category, but I did find another Pluto-based book, which could be a lot of interest for people who are interested in Pluto. This is Neil deGrasse Tyson's The Pluto Files, The Rise and Fall of America's Favorite Planet. It's available on Audible Podcast, and you could make it your free audiobook download. Once again, audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. And I thank audible.com for sponsoring this hour of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. And we are back to Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. When are you going to get in audible.com, Alan?
Yeah, we're going to have to get Audible on that.
Got to get on it.
That's a great thing. You know, if Neil has his book on there, I got to get my book, you know, tell the other side of the story.
Exactly.
So let's work on that, Kiki.
We will work on that. And in the meantime, if people are also interested, we have not put out a link yet for your book, but if people are interested, they can go to thecaseforpluto.com. And at thecaseforpluto.com, there is a whole bunch of information about the book and about the topics of the book, some excerpts from various chapters. You can find out more information about our illustrious guest, Alan Boyle, and browse through some things. And you can also order it direct from the website. But I'm sure it's available many, many places. Where have you been that's been one of the most, I guess, fun places for you while you've been touring and talking about The Case for Pluto?
Well, actually, it was a real treat for me to go to the Lowell Observatory. I mentioned that that's where Pluto was found. And so the folks at the observatory were very kind hosts, showed me around, showed me the telescope that was actually involved in the discovery, showed me the little apartment where Clyde Tombaugh, the discoverer of Pluto, stayed. That was a real treat for me. And touring around, I went to Illinois, Streeter, Illinois. That's where Clyde Tombaugh grew up and spoke with classes, elementary school kids, middle school kids, high school kids. Just had a fantastic time. And the hosts around the country have been so good to me. That's the greatest part of this experience is really fantastic. Went to California to the National Academy of Sciences center there and spoke to more than 200 people, and that was a thrill. So a lot of good experiences over the past couple of months, and this is one of them. So thank you for having me, Kiki.
Oh, you're welcome. What do you think that people are really interested in Pluto? I mean, I find myself growing up under the textbooks that showed Pluto as one of the planets, and it was always, named after a nice Disney character.
Right. That's one of the factors, that's for sure. You mentioned Neil's book that he thinks that's the big factor, that kids grew up learning about Pluto and watching Pluto in the cartoons, and so that's why Pluto has been so endearing. And I agree that that's a factor, but I think that there's also something about the idea that Pluto was the most distant planet, the lonely planet, the cold planet, the planet that needed a little bit of extra love, it was not just about the dog, it's about the underdog. The good thing is that we're finding out that Pluto is not all that alone after all. In fact, Pluto may have been the first of a class of planets that is actually the most populous class in our solar system, that it's not really an oddball planet. It's something that tells us, gives us deep insights about the formation of the solar system and its structure.
And it will probably end up being maybe the least favorite of students as they're having to memorize, a much more numerous class of planets as opposed to the old nine that we used to remember.
Well, that was never a good idea to think that if you memorized 9 or 8 names, you knew everything that you needed to know about the solar system. And so I think on one hand, it's better to think of the solar system in terms of the classes of these various objects. And on the other hand, it's pretty cool to have more names out there, like Eris, like Haumea, like Makemake, and all these other cool cats that are out there. So I wouldn't put it past kids to kind of collect these planets the way they would collect dinosaurs or baseball cards, that if you can memorize Tyrannosaurus, Gigantosaurus, and all these other dinosaurs, you can memorize Eris and Haumea and Makemake as well.
And you just might learn a few more things about the people on our own planet, because all of these names come from different cultures. And
that's right.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
So moving on, we've talked a lot about Pluto. And, you know, our solar system is a pretty awesome place. Recently, though, there is a lot of news. Obama has decided not to go to the moon, but to go for Mars-a-fest destiny.
Right.
We are on our way to Mars.
Mars-a-fest destiny. I like it.
That's right. And so if we're moving forward toward Mars now, and the focus that NASA is looking at is changed, and also the way that Washington and is even looking at how space travel should move forward, what are you seeing out there? I mean, I know this week you had a chance to interview Elon Musk from SpaceX.
Yeah, that was great. I think that the way that all this is going to play out is still very much in flux. And in fact, I've been hearing more about what Congress might be doing, and how Congress is, of course, going to have a say in how all this comes together, and that some elements of the plan that was canceled may be picked up again, perhaps in a different form. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing? If you think that there were elements that people were going to be wasting money on, that would be a bad thing. And so the real trick is to figure out what are the technologies that we need to develop in order to move beyond Earth orbit and do what we want to do, whether that's to go to an asteroid or go to the moon or go to Mars. And let's develop those technologies in the most efficient way, relying on, you know, commercial providers when that makes sense, or doing the government research and technology development when that makes sense. So I think that what we're seeing of the policy, what we've seen in the past couple of months, is not going to be the final word. And I guess the hope is that it will be better, that now that we have a series of goals that lead to Mars, we can start to organize what we need to do in order to really get going and get out there.
But isn't this the problem where, okay, Bush said, oh, we're going to go to the moon, and Obama's saying, oh, we're going to go to Mars. I mean, every time a president comes into office, are they going to completely turn about face and change the direction? I mean, this is something that can happen. A new CEO comes into a company, says, oh, we're not going to do that anymore. I need to fire all these people. We're going to go this direction now.
Yeah.
If we're looking at things like space travel and developing technologies for space travel and getting out to places beyond our own planet in an efficient way, I mean, don't we need long-term planning that's going to stay beyond the length of an administration? And how is that going to, how can that happen?
Right. Well, that's a big challenge. That's a challenge for a lot of large technology projects, is making sure you have the commitment. And in fact, NASA for 10 or 20 years has gone through a whole series of these cycles where they start to develop a technology and then it fizzled. If you remember the X-33 Venture Star project to develop a reusable space plane, the same thing happened. The difference now is that the shuttle is definitely going to be retired. And so that really focuses the will, I think. And I do think that this step-by-step approach, where you start looking at, well, what technologies do we need to develop? Of course, we all want to go to Mars at some point, but let's not you know, throw the whole kitchen sink at just getting to Mars and getting back. Let's really lay out the infrastructure for a good space transportation system rather than just going around in orbit all the time. That's really, that really makes a lot of sense. And hopefully there's a commitment, a bipartisan commitment, to go in this direction no matter who is in office. We thought we had that with the Bush plan, but it turned out that the money was not made available for doing that, that it was really an unaffordable experiment. And in the end, people had to kind of step back and say, well, what's realistic? How can we organize this in a sensible way? And I think that process is still going on. But I've always been a big fan of commercial spaceflight, and it's been fascinating to me. I think it's the only avenue we have where regular people like you or I can actually get to outer space in some way or another. And so I think this is really the way to go. It's just that we have to have the proper roles defined for who does what, and get the whole effort organized and put on a firm footing. Hopefully they'll be able to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think companies like SpaceX are going to be a part of that that platform and doing that?
I mean, do.
Is Elon Musk excited? He's probably going to be one of the first people to leave our planet and go to Mars.
Yeah. I don't know what his personal plans are when he's going to climb aboard. Some people have already told me that. Well, you know, a lot of these commercial companies, they say, well, the first people we're going to fly are our employees, just to prove that we have confidence in the safety. So I'm not sure if Elon is in that frame of mind, but I think there will have to be some efforts to assure the astronaut corps that, that going up on a SpaceX rocket is going to be the safe thing to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, whether you get Elon on there or somebody else. I think that he feels that he's going to get done what he has set out to do. And as he told me, sometimes it takes me longer than I think, but I always come through in the end. And I do feel as if he's put, you know, tens of millions. At one point, it was estimated that he put $100 million of his own money into the SpaceX development plan. And so he has invested his fortune and his reputation, and other people are investing their fortune and reputation. And so they don't want to let anybody down.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that for sure. Moving on past Elon Musk and the I guess what is the name of their rocket? It's the Falcon.
The Falcon 9, yeah.
And they're going to be testing that, aren't they? Or
yeah, that there's the maiden flight of the Falcon 9 that is supposed to be coming up in the next few weeks. It's been pushed off over and over again because they have to make sure that every detail is right, that there's something called a flight termination system, basically a self-destruct system in case the rocket goes awry. They have to have a way to push a button and make sure that nobody is hurt. And so they're still doing the testing of that flight termination system. And so that's been pushing back the launch. Right now, I think the likeliest date is somewhere around May 22nd or so, but we'll just have to see. Historically, yeah. Elon has delayed the launch. SpaceX engineers have not been shy about just calling a halt to things if everything is not right. And in fact, there have been occasions when they've called a halt, and then a couple of hours later, they'll pick up the count and get the rocket off at the end of the day.
So as a science editor, science reporter on the scene, you just have to be ready to roll with the punches.
Definitely, yeah. Uh-huh. Keep your laptop on and keep the web feed going to see how things are going to turn out. But I've done that many a weekend night to see what's going to happen with the SpaceX launch.
In other places, seeing how things are going to turn out, there was the big news the last couple of weeks has been the oil spill down in Florida. Mm-hmm. And I saw on Cosmic Log, you've also reported a bit on the methods they're using for repairing the leaks.
Right.
And today they were actually putting in place one of those, the cone to repair a leak. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's a containment chamber. It's like four stories high. It's a big, basically a big concrete box that you put over an oil leak. And then when the oil is bubbling up from that leak, it's sucked up from that containment box up almost a mile to an oil processing ship on the surface. And so they've done this sort of thing before, but never at this depth. And there are a lot of uncertainties involved. When you're bringing that box down, you have to be ever so careful to put it right on top of that leak. And when you consider the currents that are going through there and the uncertainties, it's going to be like threading a needle and very dramatic operation that's about to take place.
Yeah, and I hope it works because they've only ever tested it or it's been used at 200-foot depth. So the depth they're using it at, it's just, who knows? And they're doing it blind, right?
Well, they have remotely operated vehicles down there, and so they'll probably be kind of watching for that. It is kind of like one of these robotic medical operations where you have robots and humans relying on each other, and that's a very interesting facet of the technology, how much we've come to rely on robots in the extreme, in these extreme situations.
Much more than we probably ever thought we would, I'm sure.
And it'll unless probably... you're a science fiction reader.
Exactly. What are your thoughts on the oil spill and how things are moving forward with that? Are you reporting on that a lot, or are you just pretty much sticking to the...
I'm more on the technological angle of things. We have a whole team of people who are involved with the environmental impact of this and the human impact, what this means for people who make their living on the sea. And so if you go to environment.msnbc.com, you'll find a lot of coverage about all those aspects. I just have one small little piece of the story just having to do with the sorts of technologies that can be employed to do this thing. But it's a huge, huge story. And we have lots of people, my colleagues, that are working on it 24/7.
What are some of the other technologies that they're going to try and be? There were a couple of others that you were reporting on. What else is going to help the spill? I mean, it's going to just keep leaking. Mm-hmm. Probably what we won't be able to really stop it. Right.
So the containment box is kind of like a glorified vacuum cleaner. You're just kind of pulling up the dirt as it comes up through the floor. But a long-term fix, you're going to have to go and stop the leak somehow. And so that's what they're getting ready to do also. In fact, they've begun to drill what they call a relief well that will come in from the side and intersect with the oil fissure. And then when they pump mud and concrete down that relief well, it will start welling up through the pipe that's leaking. And the idea is that that will solidify and that will close off the oil well. And so they think that could take as long as 3 months to complete. So, and it may not work the first time. I think the New York Times had a story about this case in Australia where they tried to dig a relief well and they just couldn't get it in the right place. And they had to do it five times in order to get it right. So again, it's a dramatic dramatic operation that is not a slam dunk.
Right. So we can hold our breath, but it might not help us out very much if we were to do
that. Well, you have to have a plan B and C and D, and that's where all this attention that's being paid to booms and dispersants and cleanup comes into play. So it's a very complicated story, a lot of moving parts.
Okay, final story. I know we're getting to the end of the show here. Final story, your cosmic log report for today is really interesting, and I really want you to tell everybody about it.
Oh, about the Neanderthal genome. Well,
yes.
Scientists have been working on decoding the Neanderthal genome for 4 years, and they finally released a draft of the genome today. And one of the things that this study does is it appears to settle the question whether Neanderthals and ancient humans did it. Yes. Yes, they did it.
They did it. I have been betting on this for years.
Yeah. But not all that much. And so they were able to quantify how much of the DNA from Neanderthals had flowed into the human genome. And they say it's between 1 and 4%. Another interesting aspect of this is that not all the human genomes that they sampled appear to have these traces of Neanderthal DNA to the same amount.
Oh, that's
if you came from Africa, you were less likely to have code in common with the Neanderthals than if you came from outside Africa. And so The implication of this is that Neanderthals and humans did it, but they didn't do it in Africa. They interbred perhaps in the Middle East, just as humans were coming out in a wave of migration out of Africa and starting to head toward Asia as well as Europe.
Wow. That's fascinating. So they basically Neanderthals were probably out in those areas, and then the humans started coming out, migrating out. They met each other. They probably fought a lot. They probably...
It's the same old story. Human girl meets Neanderthal boy. You know how it goes. But the more interesting things is what this genome can tell us about modern humans.
Yeah.
What is it that made us human? There are some indications that that the differences that occurred, the changes that occurred after our encounter with the Neanderthals had to do with cognitive function. And so it really gets into those issues of whether brain function had something to do with helping us to compete better against a rival population of hominids. It could even go to what the anatomy of a human is versus a Neanderthal, that there may be particular genes that were turned on in order to make us look, less like the stereotypical Neanderthal and more like Angelina Jolie.
And there are many people today who are very happy for those genes being turned on.
Indeed.
I love the breadth of the stories that you report on. Do you love it? The fact that you get to report on so much stuff and learn about so many different things.
I do. Sometimes I wish I could just learn about it and not have to write about it.
I've seen you on Deadline. I know.
So, it's not all a bed of roses, but it is fascinating. And I do like the idea that I am able to report on dwarf planets one day and then Neanderthal DNA the next day. That's kind of a neat thing to do.
Yeah, it sounds neat. So we're at the end of our show. Thank you so much, Alan, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We, let's see, if you want any more information about Neanderthals and their DNA, or about oil well recovery technologies, or even about Pluto, you can go to the Cosmic Log, and that website is cosmiclog.com. Cosmiclog.com. And we were just there a moment ago. I'll go back to it very quickly so you can take a look. Cosmiclog.com. It's on MSNBC. Additionally, you can go to Case for Pluto. Oops, wrong link. thecaseforpluto.com, How a Little Planet Made a Big Difference. This is Alan Boyle's book. You can learn all about Pluto if you wish. That's it.
And who wouldn't want to?
It's in bookstores now.
Yeah.
It is available now, so check it out. I suggest you do, and I can do that here.
Yay!
Yay! Yes. So cosmiclog.com, thecaseforpluto.com, if you're interested in any more of Alan's writings. He is around and about MSNBC.com on a constant basis, and occasionally you might just see him on MSNBC as a reporter. I'm wrapping up. I'm Dr. Kiki. This has been The Science Hour. If you would like to contact me, you can do so at drkiki@twit.tv. That's drkiki@twit.tv. You can also find me online by searching for Dr. Kiki. I have a fan page in Facebook. If you'd like to like me now, you can no longer fan me, but you can like me. So if you like me, like me.
And, we like you.
Thank you. And on Twitter, again, Dr. Kiki. I'm all over the internet as Dr. Kiki. That's pretty much all you need to know. And I will see you next week. We are going to be speaking with Dharmendra Mota from IBM about making synthetic brains. Last week, we talked about teaching the synthetic brain how to think, and we're going to talk about how IBM and other researchers are actually trying to develop new materials and new chips to be able to make smarter, better, faster robots that'll take over the world. I'll see you next week. Thanks for tuning in. I really do appreciate it. And remember, it's not just an hour of science. It's your world.